The next factor that influences the aging process is relationship. There's ample research that shows how we relate to others, whether it's in our family, in our work, in our social setup. All this influences aging. Now, what does Ayurveda say about relationship? There are some very simple, basic principles. Number one, we can only nourish a relationship. That should be our role. Number two, we cannot change other people by telling them to or trying to make them change. It hasn't worked in the entire history of humanity, so we shouldn't try to do it. Even a war is the ultimate defense of a point of view. You want to change something, and that hasn't worked in all of history. So when we evolve and change ourselves, our environment changes, our relationships change, because in fact our environment is our extended body. It's an expression of ourself. And one of the most important things in relationships that we can do is lose the need to defend our point of view. It doesn't mean that we don't have a point of view, we just are not rigidly attached to defending it. Because after all, life is the coexistence of all kinds of points of view. And as we saw earlier, the mechanics of perception are such, even physiologically, that no two people are going to experience a given reality in exactly the same way. So it is not necessary to manipulate another person's experience of reality. As long as you lose your rigid need to defend your point of view, that in itself will improve the relationship. The three keys to an effective relationship are: don't judge, don't rationalize, and don't defend your point of view. When you stop judging, interpreting, evaluating, analyzing, labeling, defining, describing even, in that silence of non-judgment, spontaneously, there is healing and effective relationship. Silence comes because most of the background noise in our brains is nothing other than the noise of judgment. Even though the connection may not seem obvious, we make things happen, even though we may perceive them as happening to us. And rationalization is just an excuse for the experience, basically, of things happening to us. It's a change in perception that is necessary. If we just practice these very simple principles, our relationships become magical. Most people spend their entire life defending that they are correct. So the moment you stop trying to do that, you are approaching defenselessness. Defenselessness is actually the key to invincibility. When you let down all your defenses, there is nothing to attack. It's true that that applies to ourselves also, that we don't judge ourselves, we don't try to defend a point of view to ourselves. I'm reminded of a statement that Mr. Gorbachev made a few years ago to President Reagan. He said, "We're going to do something terrible to you. We're going to deprive you of an enemy." When you let down all your defenses, nobody can attack you because there's nothing to attack. And that really is ultimate power. Ultimate power does not allow the birth of an enemy. And the mechanics of that is simple, effective defenselessness. Just consider the number of arguments you have in a week. That's a good measure of how defensive or defenseless you are. Finally, in Ayurveda, an effective communication involves the understanding of body types. Because, again, different people, depending on their body type, interpret reality in different ways. If we understood how these body types are derived, then it becomes clear that Vata body types, for example, are more responsive to sound and touch. Pitta types are more visual. Kapha types respond more emotionally because emotions are connected with the sense of smell and taste. So it's very important when you're trying to nourish a relationship to know or have some idea of how that person interprets his reality. If the person is a pure Vata type, then they would really understand or communicate much better through words, through sound, and even through touch. If they are Pitta body type, they need to be shown graphically. So they respond more to the written word or to a visual image or to colors. Kapha body types respond to emotions, and emotions also are connected to the experience of taste and smell. Let's assume there is a husband and wife relationship. A Vata person, they need to be touched, stroked, cuddled, spoken to. A Pitta person, they need to be shown through flowers, gifts. That's how you show your appreciation. A Kapha person, you take them out for dinner or you buy them a perfume. You'll find that they respond much more. It's not manipulative. It's just nourishing a relationship by understanding a person's needs. That's what it means. And that is our role in a relationship. So let's move on to another factor that influences aging, and that is the quality and quantity of sleep. After all, we spend one-third of our lives sleeping. And the quality of sleep is that sleep that when you wake up, you feel energetic. You feel that you're bubbling with energy, ready to take on the world. Or do you feel tired when you wake up? Or do you feel unrefreshed when you wake up? This is what we mean by quality of sleep. In Ayurveda, we say that the sleep should be blissful, in that it should be the experience, really, of silence. And also, there is in sleep the necessary requirement of the dream state of consciousness. It's known, for example, that people who are deprived of their dream state, they have excessive fatigue and are much more prone to illness. The most frequent causes of deprivation of dreams are things like tranquilizers or sleeping pills or alcohol. These are the most frequent cause of sleep deprivation. That's why when people withdraw from these drugs, they frequently have hallucinations. They're just catching up on their dreams, even in the waking state of consciousness. Now, in dream state, our eyes perform certain movements that are called rapid eye movements. In the previous sessions, we discussed that when we are visualizing something, our eyes move up and to the left. In dream state of consciousness, that also happens. And it's very necessary that we have that dream state of consciousness. How is it brought about? How does one improve the quality of sleep? If one has a sleep disorder, it's usually because of Vata imbalance. So anything that will correct Vata imbalance will improve the quality of sleep. Some of the things that one can do if one is suffering from a sleep disorder is eat the foods that pacify Vata. When I refer to sleep disorder, I'm talking about insomnia or absence also of clear dreams, which is part of the blissful experience of sleep. Some people do not remember their dreams, but those people who have the experience of silence more and more, they remember their dreams, and there is a witnessing quality to their dreams also, in that they are dreaming and yet there's a wakefulness inside that is witnessing the dreams. Physiologists have called this lucid dreaming. The better the quality of sleep, the more clear and lucid the dreams become. Treating a sleep disorder such as insomnia involves mainly following a Vata pacifying diet and having a light supper, and it should be about 2 or 3 hours before you go to sleep. A Vata pacifying diet is included in the written material that comes with this program. Other suggestions for improving the quality of sleep are things like decreasing the sensory input before sleep, in that it shouldn't be too stimulating. So the sensory input should be soft music, perhaps aromatherapy, which is pacifying to Vata imbalances. And also there are certain herbs that are very effective in improving the quality of sleep. And these include saffron, two or three threads heated in a cup of milk just before bedtime, or nutmeg, a large pinch stirred into a cup of warm milk also before bedtime, or an herb called poppy seed, and there's also gotu kola, it's an Indian herb. 1 teaspoon or 1/4 teaspoon of the powder brewed into tea with 1 cup of water. These herbs are all available in health food stores. How about the quantity of your sleep? It varies. A vata type may need only 4 to 6 hours. A pitta type may need somewhere between 6 to 8 hours. A kapha type may in fact need more, even more than 8 to 9 hours sometimes. So the amount of sleep is really based on your body type. The basic thing to remember is when you wake up, you should feel refreshed, you should feel energetic, and you should feel like you're ready to take on the world, take on any challenge. That sense of energy should be there in both body and mind. One of the most important factors that accelerates the aging process is, of course, stress. My definition of stress is that it is the interpretation of psychological or physical threat. It's not something there in the environment. It's not something in you either. Stress is your interpretation of what's happening in the environment. So two people, given the same situation, one could feel exhilarating joy, the other could feel stressed. Two people could be on a roller coaster ride and one person gets exhilaration out of it. He makes these very powerful interleukins in his body. These are anti-cancer drugs. Another person experiences the same roller coaster ride and he's petrified and he experiences stress. He brings about all these chemicals in his body that ultimately result in the generation of free radicals, which we know cause aging and entropy and all kinds of other diseases. Now, there are many researchers who say that there are some kinds of stress that are good for you, and we are just using different labels, basically. If you interpret a situation as threatening to you, then no matter what definition you use, that's stress, and that's not good for you. If, on the other hand, the same situation acquires a meaning of challenge for you or becomes an opportunity for you, then, of course, it's no longer stress. So stress is basically an interpretation of threat. Therefore, stress is an internal dialogue. So although there are many techniques for stress management, and these include music, imagination, visualization, massage, aromatherapy, a change in environment, the experience of laughter, watching a movie, etc. All these are an immediate switch from the perception of threat into another experience. And therefore, they are effective stress management techniques. In my experience, meditation, and particularly transcendental meditation, is one of the most effective stress management techniques because it allows the mind to settle down to more abstract levels of awareness and then ultimately transcend the whole thinking process so that one experiences a state of consciousness which is without thought content. So one has that experience of solitude, of connectedness, of silence, which is the most important experience necessary for us to have because it gives us contact with that part of ourselves which is non-changing, that silent witness aspect of ourselves. Transcendental meditation, incidentally, can be taught in all the cities in the United States. Everywhere there are TM centers, so it's very easy to find out how to learn that. There is ample research on the physiological effects of transcendental meditation, but one of the most important papers was published in the Journal of Neurosciences that showed that those people who had been transcending regularly for more than 5 years, their biological age was about 12 years younger than their chronological age. That's a very astonishing result. And recently, Dr. Ellen Langer and Dr. Charles Alexander published an article in the Journal of Behavioral Sciences that revealed that elderly people who practice meditation regularly live much longer than those who don't. So I think the research is quite unequivocal in the effect of the ability of the experience of silence to create silence in the body, silence in the mind to create silence in the body, as a result even prolong the aging process, and in fact reverse some of the changes that are known to occur with aging. One of the most important factors that influence the aging process is job dissatisfaction. We live in a universe which is like a big jigsaw puzzle, and each part must fit. There are no spare parts in the universe. So we have a very important role to play in this universe, and when we are playing that role, we feel a sense of comfort in our bodies. We feel a sense of comfort in our mind. Essentially, we are referring here to a very basic concept in Ayurveda, and that is the meaning of dharma. Dharma is our purpose in life. We have some purpose that we are here for. If that purpose is not clear to us, then we will flounder. We will go from here to there, and that ultimately also expresses itself as job dissatisfaction. On the other hand, if we know very clearly why we are here, what's our role, we are here for a specific purpose, and that purpose is our dharma. When we are in dharma, then we enjoy our job. We feel a sense of comfort in our bodies, and there is a spontaneous flow to what we are doing. We accomplish things without effort. It's effortless. It's just completely effortless, spontaneous, and it's like swimming downstream instead of swimming upstream. If you really enjoy your work, then it shouldn't cause fatigue, it shouldn't cause stress, and if you don't enjoy it, then it's definitely creating a lot of harmful toxins in your body and generating all these free radicals. These are the final expressions of that. And in fact, job dissatisfaction and self-happiness rating are the two most important risk factors, not only for heart disease, but also for other diseases. And finally, two more factors that we should mention. One is the experience of humor, the experience of laughter. In the past, I have traveled with some great Ayurvedic physicians who are pulse diagnosticians also. And they put their hand on a person's pulse and they diagnose things like laughter deficiency. And their prescriptions to their patients are, watch funny movies more frequently, or read comics, or play with children. Learn to laugh. Learn to laugh even at yourself. And finally, our perception of time. Whenever you feel that you have a deadline and it's causing a lot of stress to you and discomfort in your physical body, always pause a little bit and ask yourself, what would happen if you didn't accomplish what you have set out to do? Ask yourself, what is the worst scenario? What's the worst thing that could happen if you didn't accomplish the goal in the given period of time? The sooner you lose your rigid attachment to the outcome, you find, in fact, that you can accomplish the goal with much less effort. It is the rigid attachment to the outcome that interferes with the whole process. And if our orientation is not so outcome-oriented, but process-oriented, if you switch your orientation from outcome to process, you can accomplish a lot more by doing a lot less. In the written material that accompanies this program, you will find an aging risk self-assessment. And basically, there are just a few questions that you can answer on happiness, on your sense of bodily comfort, on how you view aging psychologically, on the amount of exercise you do, the kind of nutritional intake that you have, the kind of emotions that you're prone to. Also, there are questions about relationship and quality of sleep. It's a very simple test that you can do. And doing the test will allow you to determine for yourself the areas in your life that you need to pay attention to in order to have a more effective control over the biology of aging as it's occurring in your physiology. When we discuss the aging process, we have to also address one very important factor that influences how long we live and also the quality of our life. There's an expression in Ayurveda again, which says Ayurveda is not just for adding years to your life, it must add life to your years. So it's important not only to live long, but to have that quality of life, which is so important, that experience of happiness, basically. And one of the basic concepts here to understand is that there are three forces that structure all of nature. One is the force of creation, the other is the force of maintenance, and the third is the force of destruction. If you look at a quantum field, for example, you see a particle emerges from the void. That's the creative act. Then it becomes a wave in the field. That's the moment of attention where it is there for a short period of time. And then it disappears back into the void. And these three forces are operating everywhere in nature. We see things are renewed. So in order for renewal to take place, the old must go. And in fact, that's how we recreate our bodies all the time. Our skin cells slough off and we make new ones. Our stomach linings change every 5 days. We're making a new skeleton every 3 months and so on. The creative force, if it dominates, that will influence how a person will age. Biological expression will be different when the creative force dominates. And there are certain characteristics of that creative force that express themselves in us as our own creativity. The more creative we are, the longer we will live and the better our quality of life will be. So I'd just like to briefly mention the characteristics that creative people have. One of the most important characteristics of creative people is that they are able to enjoy periods of silence and solitude. They are able to be with themselves. A second characteristic of creative people is that they can connect with and enjoy nature. They are happy in natural surroundings. They don't suffer from picnic deficiency, so to speak. Another characteristic of creative people is that they trust their feelings much more than their intellect. When confronted with a situation, they are more likely to go with their feelings than with what they perceive in their mind as the right or wrong thing to do. What is feeling? That experience of comfort or discomfort in your body. When confronted with a situation, ask your body whether it feels comfortable doing that or not. If there's a sensation in the body that is uncomfortable, then that is not the right thing to do. This is intuition. Intuition is not a thought. It's the non-local cosmic field of information that whispers to you in the silence between your thoughts. And that expresses itself as this message of comfort or discomfort in your physical body. So anytime you need to make a decision, rather than intellectualizing about it and trying to understand it intellectually, which is all right, but not always the ultimate test of whether it's the right decision or not, go with your feelings. And feelings are sensations. If the sensation in the body feels good when you do something, then that's the right decision. A very crucial test of intuition is the sensation that occurs in your physical body. A fourth characteristic that creative people have is that they can enjoy themselves and function in the midst of chaos and confusion. So creative people are not usually terribly organized. They're usually not very goal-oriented either. They're much more process-oriented. Because they have this inner stability, they function extremely well, even in the midst of chaos and confusion. A fifth characteristic of creative people is that they are childlike. Not childish, but childlike. They enjoy fantasy and they enjoy play. A sixth characteristic is that they are self-referral. And this is an important point, and therefore I'm going to address it in a moment, having mentioned the seventh characteristic, which is that creative people are not rigidly attached to the defense of their point of view. So those are the seven characteristics as we see them in creative people. The most important characteristic, however, is that creative people are not object referral, they are self referral. These two terms need a further explanation. Object referral means that a person refers to objects in the environment in order to understand himself. These objects could be situations, circumstances, people or things. But whenever a person refers to objects to seek his identity, then he is in the object referral mode. An object referral person evaluates, understands, and tries to know himself through the eyes of others. The characteristic ingredient of object referral is conditioned response and conditioned thinking. It's living under the hypnosis of social conditioning. Now, let me give you a story that illustrates what object referral is about. It's a fable from India. It's a very interesting little story that gives us a taste for what the word object referral means. There was once a man, and he had only two things that he valued in his life. One was a little pony that he had, and the other was his son. His entire reality came from referring to these two objects, basically. His whole sense of reality, his whole world was just this pony and his son. And one day the pony disappeared, and he was devastated because he had lost half his fortune, so to speak. Half of what he valued had disappeared. And he was in the depths of despair and anguish and misery, thinking about his lost pony, when the pony returned, and with the pony was a beautiful white stallion, an Arabian horse such as he had never seen. Absolutely beautiful animal. So suddenly, from the depths of despair, he was in the heights of ecstasy. He was completely overjoyed now. And the next day, his son was riding the pony and fell down and broke his leg. So again, from the heights of ecstasy, he was in the depths of despair and anguish and misery. He was wallowing in his misery when the government sent some army people to take all the young men to the war. And they took every young man from the village, but they left his son behind because he had a broken leg. So again, from the depths of despair, he was in the heights of ecstasy. And you can, of course, guess that the story has no ending. This is the story of object referral. Objects, by their very nature, change. And as long as we are identifying ourselves with objects, we do not know ourselves. We evaluate and understand ourselves through the eyes of others. Our life is like a roller coaster ride. Because the only non-change about things and people and situations and circumstances is that they change. And if our identity is tied to that, then life is always going to be unstable. The first sign of object referral is fatigue, because we have relinquished our power to the object of reference. As a result of relinquishing our power to the object of reference, the first symptom we experience is fatigue. And ultimately, that causes discomfort in our bodies, it causes dis-ease in our bodies, and is, in the Vedic worldview, the basic reason for unhappiness and therefore of ultimately even disease. Happiness being the most important factor in health. The opposite of object referral is self-referral. A person who is self-referral feels wonderful all the time, regardless of the situation, regardless of the circumstance, regardless of the environment he or she is in. And why does he feel wonderful, regardless of the situation? because he doesn't identify himself with that. He's the detached witness of that. He also has no urge to prove this to anyone. Because if he had the urge to prove this to someone, then again he would be evaluating himself through the eyes of others. This is the state of bliss. So bliss is different from happiness. For happiness, there's always a reason. Somebody said, I love you, that makes you feel happy. Or you won the lottery and you made $1 million, that made you feel happy. So happiness is in fact an expression of object referral. You're happy because of this. You're happy because of that. But bliss is independent of the environment. When you experience bliss, you're happy without any reason. Just the mere fact of being alive, to watch the stars, to experience nature, to be experientially alive in the miracle of life itself is the experience of bliss. And the characteristic ingredient of self-referral is the value of silent witnessing. What are the mechanics of the spontaneous fulfillment of desire? Why do some people have all their desires come to them effortlessly? They get fulfilled effortlessly. We call them lucky people. And why do some people always go through life as if it was a big struggle? And Ayurveda has a lot to say about this, but we shall address the most crucial questions, the most crucial concepts. What is desire? Desire is pure potentiality seeking manifestation. It's the whole mechanics of creation. That's how the universe comes. The universe is a field of all possibilities which interacts with its own self. So pure potentiality seeks manifestation through desire. Inherent in having the desire is the mechanics for its spontaneous fulfillment. A gardener, when he plants a seed, doesn't try to make it sprout. He doesn't doubt that it will manifest into a plant. Other people's opinions do not interfere with his conviction that the seed contains within it everything necessary to create the tree. And he doesn't get lost in his attachment to the result. He knows it's there. All that is required is attention and non-interference. So similarly, the mechanics of fulfillment of desire is that we not interfere with it. Inherent in having the desire is the whole mechanics for its spontaneous manifestation. When I have the desire to walk from here to there, I don't fully verbalize and give myself affirmations that these are the instructions for my body to move from here to there. It happens spontaneously. Inherent in having the desire is the whole mechanics of it. Or when I go to sleep at night, I just don't lie down in the bed and say, come on body, change your state of consciousness to sleep state. I don't do that. I don't try to go to sleep. Inherent in having the desire is the mechanics for the transformation of my physiology to go to sleep. So the only thing we can do wrong is to interfere. Interference means using effort, trying. We interfere when we try, when we doubt, when we listen to others' opinions, when we get lost in our attachment to the result, instead of just being and having the notion, the desire. In order to acquire power over anything, we just have to relinquish our attachment to the outcome, which doesn't mean that we don't want the outcome. Of course, we prefer the outcome to anything else, but we are not rigidly attached to it. We have the desire, and then we let go, trusting that circumstances and situations will provide the necessary details for its manifestation. The more we let go, the more spontaneously our desires appear to get fulfilled. When things don't seem to go my way, I let go of my idea of how they should be, trusting that for the moment at least, I do not know the larger picture. But in the overall context, that larger picture is good for me. It's the old paradigm of separation, which says I have to work hard in order to accomplish my goals. And the harder I work, the more likely it is that my goals will get accomplished. This is a very Western concept, but does nature work like that? Do you see any effort in nature? Do you see any effort in the migration of a bird from Siberia to South America? Do you see any effort in the organizing ability of intelligence in my body that can do infinite number of things all at the same time and monitor the movement of the stars? Do you see any effort in a seed becoming a tree and bearing fruit? Nature functions with maximum efficiency. And the principle in nature is do less, accomplish more. If we mirror the way nature works, we also can do less and accomplish more. So we go to that field of silence from where all creativity comes. We have the desire, we let go, and we watch the results as they come. And sometimes it seems to us that the results are not coming. Then we have this inner attitude of acceptance in that we recognize that maybe for the moment we are not knowing the larger picture. And not knowing the larger picture, I still have trust in the universe that it's handling all these details for everything and everybody, and therefore it'll do so for me. So the only way I could interfere with the manifestation of desire is by effort, is by hard work, is by trying too hard. It's like a gardener, as I said earlier, he plants the seed and then he lets go. He just gives it attention, and it is unconditional attention, and he has no doubts. Same thing. You have a goal in your awareness, you give it attention and have no doubts. Be effortless about it and it'll come. When I have the desire to walk from here to there, my body does it. In fact, anything that happens in my body is a faint desire. And the less I worry about the mechanics of it, the more efficient it is. The moment I start worrying about the mechanics of it, it loses its efficiency. See a ball player hit a home run, or see a fielder go after the catch. Does he worry about the mechanics of it? No. It's completely spontaneous. It's what people call flow. Even before the batter has hit the ball, the fielder has started moving. He has anticipated before the event, non-verbally, in his awareness, the mechanics of going after the ball. In fact, there's complete effortlessness. And this is the key to fulfilling any desire, and it's also the key to efficient action. I was talking to Joe Namath a few weeks ago. He also meditates, and we were discussing our experiences in meditation. And he said shortly after he started doing transcendental meditation, he had this experience in one game where suddenly he felt that he wasn't playing the game. That the game was playing itself out through him. And he was just moving spontaneously, effortlessly, in the right direction, the right moves. Everything was completely non-verbal. Thought is not involved. As soon as desire begins to flow, then thought is not involved at all. A good musician will tell you that. A peak experience comes where he doesn't seem to be playing the music. The music is playing itself out through him. A good dancer will tell you. After a while, it doesn't feel like he's doing the dance. The dance is expressing itself through the dancer. That's how songwriters write poems. Philosophers write philosophy like that. It comes to them, and then they miss it so much. Because if you've had a taste for it, anybody who's even played a game effortlessly knows what it is. You've had just a little taste of it, it's enough to change your whole life. And this is how the universe expresses itself, through effortless being, which is pure potentiality, seeking manifestation by having the desire, letting go. That's what magical thinking is. If I were to really find out if somebody had magical thinking or not, I would ask them two questions. Number one, how easily do you find your desires getting fulfilled? And number two, what is the quality of your desires? Because as we evolve to higher states of consciousness, our desires change their quality also. They're not selfish desires anymore. There is an element of that always, because we are, after all, separate on the perceptual level anyway, so there's an element of that. But more and more, your desires become whole. They are for other people also. And that's why, when your desires are for other people also, not just for yourself, then you have the whole force of nature behind you. When they are only for yourself, then you don't have the infinite intelligence of nature behind you. But when they are for other people, then all of nature works with you. You have become a citizen of the universe. There are laws of cause and effect that operate in the universe. And ultimately, if we want something, then we must know how to give it. If we want love, we have to give it. If we want respect, we have to give it. If we want money, we have to give it. Anything that you want, you have to learn how to give. And anything that is of value, by giving, you can never really lose it. If by giving, you lose something, then it was worthless. A thing that is really valuable, the more you give it away, the more you have it. How to tell the difference between what is valuable and what is not valuable? One of the tests is that the more you give it, the more you have it. And two, things of true value, they're always there. Things that have no value, they come and go. If you want to fulfill your desires effortlessly and smoothly, be aware of the following things. Number one, recognize yourself as the creator of all your experiences. Number two, be completely self-referral. In this comes the spontaneous recognition of the perfection of your inner self. Don't be object-referral. We talked about what the difference was. Number three, do not create boundaries through descriptions, labels, definitions, interpretations, analyses, judgments, evaluation. In other words, stop feeling the need to classify things as good or bad, right or wrong. They just are, instead of always feeling the need to classify them, accept them as they are. Number four, established in being, perform action. This means to desire and then let go. It implies complete confidence and trust in the universe or cosmic intelligence to take over the details. This cosmic intelligence is, after all, what is running the machinery of my body. It's running the machinery of nature. It is keeping the stars in their position. So if I can trust it to do all of that, then I can trust it to handle the details of my desire. And when sometimes things don't seem to go my way, I let go of my idea of how they should be, trusting that for the moment, I perhaps do not know the larger picture. And finally, seek always bliss. Make bliss the primary reason for existence, the motive for all actions, the primary purpose of life. Create always joy for yourself and for others.